Welcome to Beat Infertility, a podcast where we get real about infertility, empower you to take back control, and provide you with hope for the future. Ready? Here's your host, fellow infertility warrior, Heather Hooman.
Welcome to episode 274. Today you'll hear the success story of a woman named Jamie. She is a 37-year-old stay-at-home mom who enjoys exercising, reading, and drinking coffee. After two early miscarriages before each of her first children, Jamie knew her fertility was not normal for a woman her age. When she tried without luck to conceive her third child, she knew she had to dig deeper. A multitude of blood tests uncovered low AMH. Her doctor also discovered she had a blocked left tube, but she was told not to worry. IVF was not an option for Jamie and her husband, so they tried medicated timed intercourse and a few IUIs, all unsuccessful. A small polyp was removed near her blocked tube, but the tube itself remained blocked. An attempt to open it via hysteroscopy was unsuccessful, but a tubuloplasty worked. A medicated timed intercourse cycle produced a follicle on the right ovary, but was unsuccessful. They decided to try one more IUI cycle and became pregnant with their third child. Let's listen to how Jamie returned to the fertility clinic for baby number four and is currently halfway through her pregnancy. Hi, Jamie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather. Thanks for having me.
Why don't we start by introducing you to our audience? How old are you? What do you do for a living? And what do you do for fun?
I am 37. I previously was a consultant for an IT firm. I mostly did project management. And for fun, right now I exercise. Currently, I'm staying at home with my children. So
think about life before infertility. Back then, how would you describe yourself as a person?
I didn't worry about much. I knew eventually I wanted children. It wasn't something that was weighing on me heavily until after I turned 30. I was kind of in a series of dead-end relationships at that point. I was out and about. I liked to go out with my friends. I liked to have fun. Everything was a little bit more relaxed. It was a little easier, but definitely not as full.
Tell me about the first time you met your husband.
I had just started a new job and I was in a new building, and he also started a new job in the same building on the same day. I was 30, he was 28, and we met in HR and he kind of blew me off for months. We were the younger crowd in the building. Everybody else had been there for a long time. It was an older company and older crowd, and I was a little offended that he didn't want to be friends because we were around the same age and starting on the same day and we had met. But I guess the reality was he was intimidated by me and didn't know how to approach me and talk to me. So it took us about 3 months to become friends and start hanging out. And one hangout was all it took for us to kind of realize we were on the same page and we wanted the same things and that we liked each other. And we got married about 6 months later.
Today, how would you describe you and your husband as a couple?
I think that we are stronger than ever. Its toll, the infertility did, but we were fortunate enough to have had children before the infertility. So we had secondary infertility. So we had something to draw our focus away from it a little bit. You know, we had numerous discussions about our plans to move forward and how we were going to go about things. And it just, you know, it opened up more communication, more intimacy, more details about everything, how we feel, what our beliefs are. And I think it made us stronger. It was tough, but it made us stronger.
Was there a specific moment in your life when you first knew you wanted to be a mom?
This is so silly, but I actually, when I was 22, I did not want kids. 23, I got a dog. That made me maternal. I still didn't think I wanted kids, but I held my friend's baby. She actually lived next door to my parents. She had a newborn. Her name was Ruby, and I held Ruby, and that was when I knew I needed one. So I was 25 when I finally decided that I needed to absolutely have a child.
How did longing to be a mom impact other decisions in your life?
Well, as I mentioned before, I was in kind of a series of dead-end relationships. It was my fault they were dead-end relationships. I was the one that didn't want to pursue things any further. But when I turned 30, I realized that I didn't have what I wanted. I didn't have the life that I wanted. If I waited any longer or kept making the same decisions on who I was dating, I was never going to get what I wanted. And what I wanted was to be a mom. And more than that, I loved my career. It was amazing and fun. And I was pretty good at it. But I knew that when the time came for me to become a mom, I wanted to be home with my kids and be able to do that. That was something that was important to me. So I kind of put myself out there and started looking for somebody who wanted the same things that I did. Kind of the way that I dated after that was I put it all out on the table and this is me and this is what I want. And I'm not going to settle anymore for anything less than what I want.
Let's dive into the journey to build your family. Take us through your whole infertility timeline.
Okay. Well, so my husband and I started dating in fall of 2014, and we dated for about 4 months. He's Catholic. He was born into the church, raised Catholic. It's very important to him. I didn't have a religious affiliation at that point. It just wasn't something that my family was into ever. But we had conversations about that, and that's what he wanted for his kids. And he had some strict beliefs on birth control, and I hadn't been on birth control since I was in my early 20s. So after turning 30, I wasn't going to go back on it. I knew I wanted kids and I didn't want to mess anything up. So we ended up pregnant about 4 months after we started dating, and I had an early miscarriage. So it didn't really register with me how to feel about it. I was upset. I was sad, but I didn't know what I was missing at that point. It wasn't something that we were trying for. It wasn't something that was planned. So it was a little bit easier to kind of roll out of that one. And then right into the wedding stuff, we had decided when I found out I was pregnant that we were going to get married, which was always our plan. I mean, we knew after about 2 weeks of dating that we were going to get married. So we started planning a wedding and we didn't prevent anything and got married, went on our honeymoon, and I ended up pregnant with my first child, a daughter. I had a very great pregnancy with her. It was easy. Everything went perfectly fine. She came 8 days early, perfectly healthy, perfectly perfect. You know, once you hold your baby in your arms, you just know that I knew with her that that's what I wanted. I needed more. I wanted more kids. I wanted to be home with her. It didn't make sense financially for me to stay home with one. But I knew after I had a second one, I would be able to financially justify staying home. So we started trying again after she was about 6 months old for our second child. And we were also kind of on an accelerated timeline with me being 32 by the time she was born. So I really dug in and tried again to get pregnant. And I ended up getting pregnant 3 months after we started trying again and had another early miscarriage. And I was furious this time. This time I was angry and enraged and mad at God. You know, this is what I want. And I'm a good mother. And why is this happening? And it was just completely different from the first one because I knew what I was missing. I had had a baby and I knew that I was what I was missing. So it was a little bit harder, but it just made me more determined to get back at it and try again. My doctor told me, since it was so early, it was okay to, try again the next month. And I tried for a few months and nothing. She's such a lovely person. She kind of will take care of her patients in the way that they need it. And I needed to feel like I had some control over what was going on and have some answers. And she did some blood work on me. I didn't have any clotting problems. She did an HSG. I had a little bit of slow flow through one of my fallopian tubes, but they were both open. And then she did prescribe some a really low dose of Femara for me. And that did the trick. I ended up pregnant with my second child after that, shortly after that. And a boy, he was born October of the following year after Sally and I, or my daughter. And then I was able to stay home. But with, having kids and staying home, we knew we wanted a big family. We had always said at least four kids. That was our goal. And about 5 months after our son was born, we didn't prevent anything. I had gotten my cycle back and we just kind of went about our business for a few months trying to make sure we were timing things right and nothing happened. So I started testing my ovulation. I started, just kind of getting back in to try and get pregnant. And we had no luck for months. I went back to see my doctor. She prescribed low doses of Femara again. Nothing happened. I mean, we did about 6 months of Femara before we decided to try another HSG to see if that, there's the tale that it can kind of help clear the path and that you're more fertile after. And it seemed to work the first time. So we figured, why not see if lightning will strike twice? And so we did another HSG and found out that I had a blocked fallopian tube. Now, my doctor didn't do the HSG, so she wasn't convinced that the radiologist who performed it did it well, and she wanted to repeat it to make sure before we got upset about anything. So I ended up doing two. She repeated the procedure, and it was, in fact, blocked. She told me not to worry, that I still had one open fallopian tube, and everything looked fine, and that we could just kind of try to figure out if the one side would work, and it might take a little bit longer, but we should be okay. It was my left tube that was blocked. And I remember when my daughter was born, my first child, she had told me that I ovulated from my left side. And then she told me the same thing when when I found out I was pregnant with my son and I went in for my 8-week appointment. So I was like, okay, well, it's the side that both my kids came from. So I believed her. I trusted her. I was like, okay. So we tried for another 6 months and nothing. So at this point, we've been trying for a little over a year. I decided it was time to go see a doctor about what I could do about my fallopian tube being closed. Immediately, I went to a great doctor, a reproductive endocrinologist. He told me that it shouldn't cause me any problems, that I shouldn't worry about it, that sometimes the uterus contracts during HSGs and there's, a muscle spasm can cause it to look like it's blocked. And he was very reassuring. He gave us some options, told us to keep trying the medication and, that he could recommend we do IUIs with open side, the definitely open side. And I told him, I think I wanted to try to get the tube open. And he discussed IVF with us. He said, if this is indeed a problem in another 6 months, we can talk about IVF. And then Mike and I had a conversation about IVF and being Catholic. Mike, it's not for him. He's not against it. And we both are amazed by science and everything that they can do to help everybody now, almost everybody. But it just wasn't for him. It wasn't in his heart. It wasn't something that he wanted to pursue. And then there's me who, at this point, I really am ready for a third child and I would have probably done just about anything, but he kind of, pumped the brakes on that. And we chose to try medicated cycles with IUI, which was pushing his envelope a little further than I think he ever would have wanted to, but he did it for me and my well-being. I was struggling. I was really struggling. I couldn't, everybody who's gone through infertility knows that it's difficult to watch people around you get pregnant and have babies. And, you don't know everybody's story, but it looks so easy for everybody else. And here you are trying everything that you can think of and you're not having any luck. I mean, we hadn't had a pregnancy or a miscarriage at this point in over a year. So we tried 2 months. We were lucky enough to get the cycles back to back where I could do the IUI and the medication, and it didn't work. And at that point, I told my doctor, my OB, I just was more comfortable with her. I think that I wanted to try everything to open the tube. I told her I believed in my heart that that was the problem. And we tested, we did blood tests. We did the FSH test, and that was a little higher than they wanted it to be. And my AMH was a lot lower than anybody expected it to be. I actually had leukemia as a child. So I'm, you know, in my head worried, oh, I had cancer. Like, did the chemotherapy deplete my egg supply before? Am I ever going to be able to have another child? It was just it was a lot of in my head at that point. She went in and she did, she removed a small polyp that was close to the fallopian tube, thinking that maybe that was it. And then she ran the dye through while she was in there, and it was still blocked. And there, so she, you know, she told me that, you know, we didn't get it. We can try a laparoscopic procedure to see if we can get the fallopian tube open at that point. And so she tried the laparoscopic surgery and nothing. Like, she couldn't figure out what was blocking it. There was no indication of anything wrong with it. It looked structurally fine. The blockage was close to the uterus, which is the good blockage if you're going to have one. She told me at that point I needed to go back to the reproductive endocrinologist for further options. So we did that. We went back to the same doctor. Like I said, he's a great guy. He's retired now, but you know, he told us, like, this is not something that happens, like, that people do anymore. They just do IVF. They just go to IVF. And at this point, and there is one doctor in the area where we live in Columbus, Ohio. And he does a procedure where he will run guide wire through the fallopian tube to try to open it. He's like, it's hard to kind of pin him down to do this. It's just not something that they do anymore because there's IVF. And I said, can you get a hold of him and see if he'll do it for us? And he agreed to do the procedure. We had the procedure done in this point. It is July 2019. So we've been working on this since January or February of 2018. He agreed to do the procedure. It's called a tubuloplasty. And he went in and he ran a guide wire. He tried to run a guide wire into the fallopian tube. I was awake for the whole thing. And there was a room full of people. It was almost amusing because, you know, you're in such a vulnerable position, but they don't do this procedure. So many people wanted to see it. And I was, whatever, learn from it. It's what you need to do. So he tried to run a guide wire into my tube at that point, and he couldn't get it. So he's like, there's definitely something blocking here. He's like, I'm going to try a smaller wire. He's like, if I can't get it, then, you know, he's like, I'm at risk for puncturing your fallopian tube, causing you internal bleeding. He's like, so if we can't get this wire through, he's like, we're going to have to be done. And I said, okay, you know, please try. And he did. And he was able to get the second guide wire through the fallopian tube. He ran the dye and the tube was open. There was spillage out of the other end. And that was that. So the tube was open. And he told me, when I was in the recovery room, and he said, you know, we were successful. I have no idea what the blockage was. I have no idea what caused the blockage. He's like, the likeliness that it would reblock within a year was very high, that he would give it more about 6 months. So to get going was the message. If you're going to try now and try, you know, throw everything you can at it. So we did. I did one more month of Clomid, the month of the procedure in July, ended up ovulating from the right side again, which was fine. I didn't get pregnant. The next month, I tried gonadotropins, had two good-sized follicles when I triggered on the left side, which is what we wanted, which is what I was convinced was the problem in general. We did an IUI with that, and I ended up pregnant for the very first time in almost 2 years. And of course I was, you know, terrified because at this point I had gone through so much and I was worried about this and that. And, but everything went well. I had a really great pregnancy. We didn't find out the gender this time. I figured after everything that, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel should be extra special. So yeah. And I gave birth to my third child, my daughter, in May of 2020, right in the middle of the pandemic, which, you know, it was fine for us. We were okay. We were happy. We had our baby. And then we got to spend the quarantine year with our newborn, and it was, my husband had been furloughed from work for my last 2 months of pregnancy, and then the first month with the newborn. So I had help, and it was nice. And we just, we just were over the moon that we were able to have this baby. And, you know, we still had four in our heads. And I told my husband at that point that I was not going to take any drastic measures to get anybody else, and that I had been through the ringer and gone through three procedures to get this fallopian tube open. I had three HSGs in that time and also a saline HSG. And it was, we all know how much fun vaginal ultrasounds are. I had more than my fair share. I was ready to just see how things went. But I did tell him, I'm like, I'll check and see if the tube is open and we can just go right back to what worked for 3 months. And then I want to be done. I can't commit to this. I have all of this going on. I have these perfect, beautiful children, and I just want to enjoy them and not stress and not have any reason to be upset anymore. I can't. About 5 months after our third child was born, I went in for an HSG. I went right to the reproductive endocrinologist this time. I switched to one that was in the same practice that I had interacted with and really liked. She did the HSG. Miracle of miracles, my fallopian tube was still open. And so I thought, oh, okay, well, you know, let's get the gonadotropins ordered and, you know, like 3 months and then I'm done. Because at that point, I hadn't tested my AMH in 2 years. And it was a 1.06 when I tested it 2 years before. I was like, so there's not much chance here for me. So we'll try 3 months and then be done. And then I can move on. And so she told me, she's like, we can get them ordered. It was the end of the year. So insurance purposes, we went ahead and ordered. She's like, but I want you to do 3 months of Clomid. And I said, oh, I'll try Clomid one month. And then I just don't care for it. It just wasn't my favorite. I'd done so many months of it that I was kind of starting to worry about my own health. And so I did 1 month of Clomid, ended up pregnant again. So I am halfway with my fourth pregnancy. We got what we wanted. It's a miracle. I think it's a miracle. I had two different REs tell me, do IVF. I'll give you two more kids. Like, do IVF. And it just wasn't for us. And we found this other option. We found another way and still got what we wanted. I just wanted to share my story because, you know, every time we tell it, people are, doctors and nurses are like, wow, that's crazy. And I should say both of my children after my fallopian tube was open came from my left side. So there's no physiological reason that that side worked better for me. The right side was always open. It was always ovulating. It was always fine. But for whatever reason, I favored one side, and that side gave me all of my kids. And I knew that in my heart, I knew that that was the problem all along. I mean, I couldn't even get pregnant without that fallopian tube. So that is, yeah, that is our story. That is our low AMH and our, you know, getting the fallopian tube open saga. And it worked for us. It was worth everything that we did to get it. And being persistent and knowing my own body and advocating for myself was probably the biggest part of it. You know, everybody told me it doesn't matter. You have one side, it's fine. And I just knew that it wasn't. And you know what you know, and you feel what you feel. And it's important to know yourself and know what's best for you and fight for it. So that was what we did.
Hey, Infertility Warrior, it's Heather. This episode of Beat Infertility is brought to you by me. In addition to hosting this podcast, I'm an infertility coach who supports warriors just like you. Regular listeners know that I struggled during my journey to make good decisions and advocate for myself. As a result, it took 5 years, $75,000, 3 egg retrievals, 7 embryo transfers, 4 miscarriages, and 2 stillbirths before I finally had my daughter. In other words, I've been where you are. Now that I'm on the other side, I help people like you navigate the complicated world of fertility treatments and other paths to parenthood. I help people like you make scientifically based, well-informed decisions about your next steps rather than relying on Dr. Google and Facebook groups. I help people like you prepare for appointments, identify opportunities to ask questions, and advocate for yourself. I help people like you become an active member of your fertility treatment team rather than blindly trusting the decisions that are made for you. I help people like you become a parent faster. I only have a couple of slots open and they generally fill up fast. So if this is the help you need, reach out today. Tell me your story and learn more about how I can support you during your infertility journey at beatinfertility.co/hope. Now, back to the show. I know this podcast impacted your journey as well. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I used to listen to this podcast in my car. When I'd have the kids, my parents live about 2 hours away, so we'd drive up and I would listen to episodes. I listened to a lot of the low AMH episodes. I listened to fallopian tube episodes. I listened to IVF episodes. It was, and I would just sit in my car, drive and cry, because when you're going through it and you have a community of other women that are struggling too, it just helps you to not feel so alone. And this podcast made me unafraid to talk about it. And I met two of my closest friends while I was struggling with infertility, while they were struggling with infertility. And I got to kind of help them empower themselves to push their doctors to do what they wanted and what they felt was best for themselves. And the podcast really, like, it just made me feel less alone, less sad. I don't know if that is something that makes sense. And you don't want other people to suffer just because you're suffering. But when you can find a community that is going through what you're going through, it's helpful. It's hopeful. There was so much hope in it. There were so many people who got their pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. So it really, really impacted my journey and me. And I wanted to, share my piece of it, because if it helps one person, then I love that.
You talked about community. What was it like going through secondary infertility and fitting in within the larger infertility community?
It's harder, obviously. It's something that, like, I felt guilty. I had two beautiful, healthy children. I had one of each. I had the American dream. And I wanted more, and it made me feel a little selfish. It made me feel a little guilty that there are people who struggled harder and took more time, more effort, more energy, more money to get what they wanted. But also, nobody but me ever made me feel that way. Such a supportive community. And there are so many people who, wanting a baby is wanting a baby, whether you have five or none. It's when you don't feel like your family's complete, then it's similar. It's not the same, but it's similar. I would have been okay at the end of the day if nothing had worked, but at least I got to say that I tried everything. So like I said, nobody ever made me feel like I was wrong for wanting what I wanted, even though I already had so much. And I never failed to mention how blessed and how fortunate I was to have what I have. So it was just not done for me.
Why did you decide to start with your OB?
My OB she's magical. She's just a wonderful person. I trust her implicitly. She kind of placates to the neuroses a little bit when you're freaking out. And when I had my second miscarriage, she brought me in the office. The first time I had a miscarriage, I had a different OB, and they told me that if I wasn't 8 weeks, they weren't going to see me, and I needed to go to the emergency room if I thought I was having a miscarriage. She brought me into the office, and she gave me a hug when I cried. She's just a sweet, kind person, and she knows her stuff. I trusted her to help me, and she helped me once before, and it just seemed like the right place to start, and I was never afraid to go anywhere else. I just was so comfortable with her that it made sense to at least try what she could do. And she couldn't do gonadotropins. They did IUIs in their office, but she couldn't monitor for that. So she was never afraid to tell me what she thought was next and what was best.
You ended up seeing multiple doctors at multiple clinics. Can you tell us about your experience with each?
Sure. So the first doctor we saw was the one that we used the first time with the first baby after secondary infertility. He was a great guy. He just was very old school. It was like he had a little speech prepared. We went to him once, and I think he didn't remember seeing us, so he kind of went through the same spiel the second time. So you know that it was almost like he was selling a product. We needed him, so we just went along with what he said and told him what we wanted and pushed for what we wanted. During that, though, when he was telling me that I didn't need to worry about the second fallopian tube, I did get a second opinion from another reproductive endocrinologist at a different office. And he was the one who really was just driving at IVF. Do IVF. I'll get you two. You could have three kids. I'll do IVF. Your AMH is really low. Like, you have to like get going on this. If you wait if you wait too long, we're not going to be able to do anything. Your AMH is just going to keep dropping. And IVF, that's my specialty, IVF. Never saw that man again. But I know he's done work for people that I know in the community, and he's great at what he does, but it just wasn't for me. And then when I was going through the gonadotropin process with trying to get pregnant with my third child, I had met one of the newer doctors in the same office as our original reproductive endocrinologist, and I really liked her a lot. She was great, and I just felt a connection to her. So I knew that if we came back, that's who I would want to use. And that's who we did use this time around. And we had a very short-lived relationship with her, but just she reminded me of my OB. She was just kind and open and honest. And I didn't feel like I was a spiel for her. She listened to what I had to say. She looked over all of my notes. She knew what had happened with the secondary infertility the first time around, the fallopian tube. She had so many questions about that procedure too. She's like, I don't think I've ever seen one. And I don't think I've ever had a patient who's had one. And, you know, I'm really interested to do this HSG to see if it's still open, especially after them giving you such a short window for the tube to continue to be open. And she was really great. So everybody's different. If you don't like your doctor, switch. I almost wish I would have switched the first one, but I mean, he got the job done, so I can't complain. And he was a very nice man. And like I said, he's retired now. So I think he was just probably at the end and going through the motions, it felt like.
You've mentioned a bunch of times that you didn't want to do IVF. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
For me personally, I never, ever thought I would need it. I mean, nobody thinks they're going to need it, but I also knew that I wanted kids bad enough to do whatever it takes. And I think that if my husband had been open to it, I probably would have skipped the fallopian tube procedures and this and that and just gone right to IVF as it had been recommended by even my OB at, you know, after a while. I think it's magic. I do. But I also understand my husband's point of view on it. And, you know, you can't do these things by yourself. You can't make the decisions by yourself. And his beliefs were firm with the Catholic Church about conception taking place inside the body. And I listened to the podcasts about the IVF that they, you know, they can create inside the body. That's, you know, like unlikely, but you know, it was always in the back of my head. If I need this, like I can, you know, I can pull something out of here. We can find some way if this is, so I think it's wonderful. Like a wonderful tool. And I know so many people who have had children because of it who wouldn't have been able. I mean, my best friend is struggling to get pregnant, and she has been for years, and it's a sperm issue with her husband. So IVF is their only option. And I want her to do it. I want her to, you know, to have a child. It just wasn't in the cards for us. I figured I would try everything else before I tried to talk him out of his beliefs, which is not something that's easy to do for anybody, as I'm sure you know.
Tell us more about your thoughts behind AMH being a problem for you.
Like I mentioned before, I had leukemia as a child and I had chemotherapy. I didn't have radiation, but it never really occurred to me until I had two miscarriages that it might be a problem for me to have babies. It just wasn't something that I ever really thought about or considered. So when they tested it and the nurse called me back and told me that, this your AMH is 1.06. And I said, oh, is that okay? And she said, it's pretty low for somebody your age. I was 33 at the time. So I started doing research and looking into everything. And it scared me. I think that it caused me more stress than I probably needed at that point to have that number in hand. And I never tested it again. I refused to test it again because I was just afraid that it would make it worse for me to see it lower, to not believe that this was something that my body could do anymore. So I stopped testing it. And it was definitely worrisome. It obviously wasn't fully my issue. I don't think it helped anything, but I definitely think that if I hadn't started medicating my cycles, that, there's a chance that I wouldn't have been able to conceive the last three kids. So it's definitely, I know it's a real thing, and I know that it's a struggle for a lot of people, but I had to put it out of my head. And I think that knowing what I know about AMH now kind of helped me accept the fact that it might not happen for me, but it also, I don't know. It's a hard thing to say because, can I say that it's low when I was able to get pregnant two more times after I tested it? It was low. My IVF, our reproductive endocrinologist, was completely convinced that IVF was my only option, but it wasn't. And opening the tube and just having the procedure to do that and having that, it was kind of like a relief, like maybe this will work, kind of gave me something back that I didn't have when I was just struggling with secondary infertility and thought, that it was probably just the low AMH since that's what everybody was telling me. I think that AMH is, well, from what my doctors told me, that it's mostly an IVF thing. And I don't know if I would have been able to do IVF with the low AMH anyways. So it all worked out the way that it was supposed to. But I just, I hope that women with low AMH that can try other things do, because it was a struggle. There might be something else that's underlying. I don't know, but I'm glad I didn't keep testing it for sure.
What is your advice to other women with blocked tubes?
I say try to unblock it. If there's a doctor in your area, consult about it. It was a simple procedure. I mean, it was obviously invasive. They go in through your cervix and run a guide wire through your fallopian tube, but it worked. It worked for me, and it stayed open way longer than they ever anticipated that it was. And now I get to have two more kids because of it. It's worth a shot. It wasn't a cheap thing. We still had to pay out of pocket for some of it, and insurance covered some of it, but it was less expensive than IVF. And I think less invasive too. I've listened to and read about the IVF procedure, and I feel like I know enough about it to say that the tubuloplasty was not as invasive, but that's not for me to say since I didn't go through both. It's worth a try. It's worth something. It worked for me, and it could work for other people, and it's not something that they do a lot, and it's not something that's necessarily recommended because IVF is out there and IVF is workable. But this was too, and I think it's just important to know that it can work. The tube could be the problem, even if it's just one side. It could be the problem. Try it if IVF isn't your next step or you're not ready. I mentioned my friend who's been trying to get pregnant for years, and she has had IVF on the slate for almost 2 years, and she just can't pull the trigger. She's not ready. She wishes there was something else she could do first. If you wish there's something else you can do first, try it. It's worth a shot. It worked for me.
How did you feel the day you received your diagnosis?
The low AMH, I was walking around, I was walking around a craft store looking for picture frames, and I was completely devastated. I was worried. I was scared. I was sad, and I was afraid that I wasn't going to be able to give my husband the family that we talked about and the family that we wished for and hoped for and wanted. And that was, and I understand that sometimes things happen and you can't avoid those issues, but it was really hard to hear all of it. The fallopian tube, when I got that diagnosis, I was alarmed, but they were so reassuring that this wasn't the issue, that this wasn't going to be an issue, that it kind of made it less of an issue for me right away. But when everything else that we did didn't work and I knew that this was my problem, I started to get really anxious about doing something about it, finding something to do, finding a way, making sure that I was doing everything that I could do to have another baby. So the AMH definitely hit harder, especially after, you know, all the things that I read and listened to about it. I said the fallopian tube ended up being what was my issue. So I almost am glad that I was reassured that it was going to be okay, but I would have wasted less time and energy and medicated cycles if I had just kind of trusted my gut from the beginning and said, you know, because I asked to have it opened initially. I was like, well, can we open it? And they said, you know, there's this procedure, but we don't really do it a lot and it's not necessary and it's fine and you're going to be fine and you have this one and you are just as likely to get pregnant with one fallopian tube as you are with two. And so I just kind of backed off of it for a while. But, you know, everything happens for a reason. I have a friend who told me after my first miscarriage that one day I'll understand because you get the baby that you're supposed to have. And that resonated with me all throughout all of this. And I repeat that advice to people that I know who are struggling. If it wasn't for my first miscarriage, I wouldn't have my daughter. If it wasn't for my second, I wouldn't have my son. If it wasn't for secondary infertility, I wouldn't have my baby. You know, it just, and they're exactly who they're supposed to be. And they got here exactly when they were supposed to get here. And I have faith in that now. Like, I just stuck with me. I wasn't overly devastated after my first miscarriage, but I can't imagine life with anybody other than who I have.
What was the lowest point during your journey and how did you pick yourself back up?
Sad as it is to say, I had two friends that were struggling with infertility, secondary infertility, actually, at the same time that I was. They both got pregnant within a couple months of each other. When the second one got pregnant, and we had been all trying for about the same amount of time, when the second one got pregnant and I was the only one that wasn't, and then I had gone through so much more than they took Clomid and were able to conceive. And I'm so happy for them. You know, you're so happy when the struggle is over for someone else, but you're so sad when it's still your struggle. And you're now I'm alone in my struggle with when I had my companions that were helping me through it were over the moon, just like you should be. And they should be. And I was for them. And I was just sad for me. So I think that that was the first time I really cried about any of it. And I ended up pregnant the next month, but it was still just, it was sad. Like it was, I felt alone again and I hadn't felt alone in a long time. So that was hard. But like I said, I was over the moon for them. And you can't be anything but happy for people who struggle, who get to the end of the line. So, and we all have our babies now and they're like super cute together and it's, you know, it all worked out the way that it was supposed to, but that was rough.
What about a positive moment during your journey?
There were a lot of positive moments. Like I said, I made good friends. I had conversations with people who were struggling, who knew I was struggling and, you know, just needed some advice and what to ask their doctors and what to talk about. I mean, I was raising two kids. I was home, you know, loving every minute of that. The positives outweighed the negatives. The good always outweighed the bad. I was, you know, I was lucky and fortunate. And I knew that some of the relationships that I formed during that time are, you know, are just solidified even more because of the struggle. And I like that. And I like seeing my friends with their, you know, their infertility babies too. It's just, it helps bring a lot of joy to the situation. And I have my my daughter, like my baby girl, and she's nothing but joy. So again, and like, it was all worth it. I would do it again the same way to get the same baby. I wouldn't change a thing.
How has infertility changed you?
I think it's made me a little bit more patient with my kids, appreciate them a little bit more than I might have had I not had to struggle to get them here. I'm just really grateful. I'm happy and everything worked out for me, and I'm hopeful for other women who are struggling. I hope that people continue to talk to me if they have questions. I was pretty open about everything. I didn't hide away or shy away, or that painful question. Oh, are you guys going to have any more kids? You know, I never shied away. I said, we're trying. We're not having any luck. It's been a long time and I'm struggling. And just to be able to kind of put yourself out there and tell the truth, like be honest, it was kind of life changing for me. I was never closed off by any means, but I didn't really go into any private details of my life. And now I just am like, well, you know, I'm struggling. Like, I can't do this. And I also, the other thing that changed for me was I watch and I make sure that if I hear somebody's, oh, why don't you guys have kids? I kind of try to cut it off at the knees. I'm like, why don't you mind your own business? You know, it's not something that everybody wants to talk about. And, you know, it's not something that is necessarily their choice. And I think that I didn't realize that before, especially before secondary infertility, that those aren't questions you should be asking women, married couples, anybody. It can be really private, and it's a hard lesson to learn.
Knowing what you know now, what is one piece of advice that you give to your past self?
Don't second guess yourself. Go with your gut 100% of the time. It's usually right. And if it's not, at least you'll know that you did what you thought was best. And what else can you ask for? You're not going to look back and wonder, what if I had done something different? What if I had done this sooner? What if I had tried this? What if I hadn't done this? You're never going to know. And you might end up blaming yourself for something that is completely out of your control at that point. So just trust your gut. You know your body, you know yourself, you know what's best for you better than anybody else. You know, don't be afraid to talk to people and share what's going on, or look for a community, or talk to your husband if you're struggling, or if you need somebody or something. Just make sure you're taking care of yourself. For me, what helped me was talking about it.
What words of hope would you offer to someone who is still on this journey right now?
Don't give up. It's possible. It's probable at this point with everything that they can do for you. Just stick with it. Trust your gut, trust your body, trust your instincts. Give yourself grace. Make sure that if you need a break, you take a break and put it down. It's okay to put it down and walk away from it for a little bit and come back and pick it up later. There's hope and there's options and there's different doctors and there are different ways. So just keep trying. It's worth it. And then you'll never have to look back and wonder, what if you try everything.
Jamie, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your story. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem, Heather. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Beat Infertility. Join our free private support community at beatinfertility.co/app. If you find yourself needing additional support, visit our paid programs at beatinfertility.co/hopeyou. If you'd like your story to be considered for a future episode, please fill out the form at beatinfertility.co/contact. Until next time.